Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
And I'm Tim McIntosh.
And you are listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader, on which we are discussing Ernest J. Gaines' book, A Gathering of Old Men. And we are here to discuss through page 167. So that section ends with T. Jack's bar scene, basically. So, Tim, you were not here last week. You were in Arizona, I believe.
Correct.
So, I just want to turn to you first. You can give us a temperature check on your feelings about this novel, and then we'll dive into some questions that I have for this section. So we got a chance to emote and discuss it.
Oh, you did. Can you? I mean, I love this book.
No, I don't think we were like, we didn't run counter to that. We both still like this book.
Yeah. Did you, what was the nature of your emoting?
Positive.
I listened to it on the podcast.
Oh, I see. Okay. Uh-huh.
I'll send you the link to the app where you can download podcasts.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And did you know that there's also Patreon?
Oh, I've heard of Patreon.
Yeah. If you go to patreon.com/closereads, you can get a bunch of bonus content. Side note, before we get into the conversation, we're going to have an announcement soon, written, probably also set, talked, spoken announcement about new Patreon stuff. And we plotted together last week.
Exciting.
We've got new bonus content coming. We've got new things that we're going to be doing for those of you who sign up. So whether you want to pay $2, $5, $10, or $20 a month, or select one of those categories and pay for the whole year up front, there's going to be new stuff for you starting in very soon. So we're going to have all that information coming soon. So again, just wanted to let you know that since Tim brought it up, I mean, you know,
that's since what I happened, brought it up.
Yeah.
Right.
Since Tim brought it up. Right. Okay. So in this section, we get in the last section that we talked about, Heidi and I discussed how we get some of the reasons for why this gathering of old men is happening, why they are deciding to do what they're doing. Here we get kind of the other side of the conflict, and we get Gil, we get introduced to Gil, and we get introduced to his family, and then we get introduced to Luke Will, and we get introduced to T-Jack and his bar, and we spend a lot less time with the gathering of old men itself. So given what we just read in this section and given what we've read so far in the book, I have a question that I was wrestling with as I was reading, and I would like to have you two solve this problem for me. Actually, we can maybe open it up for some debate. Who would you say is the worst character in this book? I was going to say villain, but I don't know that the book... It seems to me that the book is kind of rejecting the notion of a traditional villain here. But who would you say is the bad guy, the baddest of the bad guys in this book? Because there's a lot of different people that could take the cake for that role. Tim, what do you think?
Well,
should we make a list of potentials?
We could. It seems to me like it's going to be Fix. That's what I'm anticipating. I mean, we're set up to kind of like, he's the last dragon that we've got to face. And Mapes is kind of like the mini dragon that, he's not even a mini dragon. I mean, he's pretty terrifying, right?
We did talk about Fix a lot, and then like how complicated he is.
Yeah.
Mapes.
You're talking about Mapes.
Mapes, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, because there's moments that we see what appears to be something like empathy from Mapes. So I don't know. Those are my two nominees. Heidi, do you have nominees?
I mean, I'm hardcore on your side on Fix as the villain. Mm-hmm. I think he's a villain. I don't even think I'd agree with David. I think he's a villain. However, I disagree on Mapes. I think Mapes is a good man. Just not a man of, and I said this last week, not a man with strong enough virtue to truly shine in this moment. But I think he's trying to mediate and mitigate with what he knows is coming or expects to be coming from Fix and his boys. I think Luke Will is up there for sure. But I think that Fix was just playing with guilt and was planning to do this all along. So planning, I think he's like wholly malevolent.
Planning to do what?
I think he was planning to go after Matthew the whole time. I think he was just testing Gil's loyalty in this section. So I do think he's like a full-on 100% villain. But I don't think all the white characters are. I think Gil is like the most poignant character so far in the whole novel.
Why do you think so, Heidi? I mean, I can.
He's caught between two irreconcilable loyalties. Mm-hmm. He's, mm-hmm. I mean, morality on one side and family on the other. And that is an impossible choice. I mean, it's a possible choice, but to the psyche, that's not something you recover from ever as a human being. And I think that's where he's at.
Yeah. It's a choice that alters you. Like, there's no way you come up the other side of that, the same person. Yeah.
I have a follow up question, Heidi. When Mapes was slapping the like different members of the assembly, did your opinion of him change later on in the novel?
Yeah, my opinion of him is that he's a complicated, I said good man earlier, but I think what I mean by that is like decent, not. I don't mean necessarily good, in the sense of like having a strong moral center. I think he's a decent man in a really caught in these conflicting social and personal quandaries. But I think he's trying to walk a middle line. And I do think he's a racist. Like, he slapped those men. It was a horrible thing to do. But I don't see him as malevolent. I don't see him as a villain.
Not in the way
I see him as a complicated, fallen character, not a villain.
And do you guys have a feeling? Do you guys have a sense that Mapes, in the middle of the novel, knows how he... Does he have a plan for bringing about a solution to this problem? Once he realizes what's going on, that all of the black characters are taking ownership of the murder so that none of them kind of like have to face the brutality, the injustice of the law. Do you like Mapes surely recognizes this at some point, like what is going on? Does he have a plan? Does he know what's like what he's going to do?
I haven't read ahead.
But I don't know. I think he's just biding his time. But this seems like the kind of novel that's going to have a twist. So
it does. It seems that way to me too. Yeah.
So maybe, but I'm leaving the possibility open. But from what I know and what I expect right now, I think he's just biding his time and trying to fend off the inevitable the best he can.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you can. Can hear my 2-year-old is outside the door.
I can hear this, the cheerful sounds of childhood.
She's saying
she
something to
for
me.
You,
probably, Beth? But she's got
probably
three siblings and Bethany
Heidi.
Out there. Yeah. Well, what did you teach her to say that when we were hiking this weekend?
Well, it was just you and the boys, like a lot of boys, including Tim.
Yeah.
And then Lydia and I, who, by the way, to all the world, you should know how darling this child is. She's ridiculous. Yeah. Like, there's a normal amount of cuteness for a child, and then there's like Lydia. So she is just the most spirited, yet also like feminine and lovely little person. So when we were on this hike exploring the wilderness around David's house, Lydia and I were the only ladies, so we had to celebrate. So I taught her to raise up her hand and, you know, raise it to the roof and say, ladies, with me. Mm-hmm. So we just wandered about calling out to the world, announcing ourselves as ladies. Hi, Lydia.
And
Lydia's
now Heidi and I are like,
screen.
She's now on the screen.
Hi, Lydia.
Can you say hi?
Hi.
Hi.
Can we teach them that we're the ladies? Do you want to do that with me? Put up your hand.
Here. She doesn't like the headphones.
She doesn't like ladies. No,
she's spirited. She's ladies.
No, now she's being shy.
No, that's okay.
So, okay. I'm just going to let her sit here while we talk about this. She is waving. So, okay. We have Mapes. We've got Luke, Will. We've got Fix. We've got, I'm writing T-Jack down. And then we've got, as a fifth sort of terrible character, we've got the deputy, who's just a fool.
Yeah, deputy. I think, David, he's too spineless flaccid to actually do any real harm, though there have been plenty of spineless people in history who have done like profound amounts of harm.
Oh, yeah. Right.
But I think he's going to be executing orders more than he's going to be like driving the wrongs.
So if we take those five characters, how do you order them in terms of what you think their awfulness?
Wickedness. Fix first.
Luke,
Will second. Yeah. Who are the others?
T-Jack, Griffin, Mapes, T-Jack, and Griffin.
Okay, Griffin, so I'm going to put Griffin third, T-Jack, and then Mapes. Although, because T-Jack is colluding, although he is trying to stay out of it, but not because he has a moral center as much as because he just wants to stay out of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So that's my ranking.
Wants to keep his customers happy. I'd go with the same.
Exactly.
I'd go with the same.
What about you, variation. David?
Yeah, do you have a...
You haven't answered the question yet.
I would put Luke Will first.
Okay.
Then T-Jack.
And why Luke Will above Fix?
Because, well, one, I think the book is telling us, setting us up. You want to get down? No? Okay. She's just waving. I thought she was waving goodbye. I think that... I think the book is setting us up for Luke Will to be the agent of chaos. Okay. I think that Luke Will is purely malevolent. Like he is full of genuine hate. I think that when you look at someone like Fix, this is a man who he has a degree of a code. You know, he's like, you know, the bad character in The Wire. You know, there's a code about him. I think that he has things that he is actually trying to preserve. I'm not saying he's not evil. I'm not saying he's not a bad guy. But I think that in Luke Will, you have pure hatred, pure malevolence. He is, you know, like a demon type character. I think Fix has a degree of... I also think the book wants us to have a degree of pathos for him. That he has lost his son. And like it sets him up to be someone who, you know, he cries. He doesn't, I think we're supposed to take it at face value. He doesn't know what he wants to do. I don't know that I agree that in the moment he is completely setting Gil up to fail. And then I think T-Jack is pretty rotten too. And in part because we get his narration. Like I think what he does is try to survive, but the way he talks is so bleak. In his narration, the way he talks about the social order and the way he describes the black characters and the way he responds to that's the negative aspects of the social order is just so bleak. I think he is a product of the social order, and thus he is kind of middle tier bad, right? He's sort of everyday bad, but I think he is pretty deeply bad. I think the deputy is. Yeah, I think he's spineless. Like, I think I would put him and T-Jack kind of in the same category. You've got...
It's interesting that three of our five bad characters, T-Jack, the deputy, and who's the third I was going to just name? Luke. They're not... They are more... They're evil... is more an evil of born of having no spine, having no backbone. Whereas characters like Fix and Mapes have a backbone. And in some ways, yeah, how do you think I say
Luke,
this?
Did you include Luke Will in the back the spineless characters?
Yeah, I do.
Huh.
But he's so aggressive. Like, he's aggressively violent. Like, all he wants, he is not afraid.
But he gets drunk before they go out.
Yeah, he's a loser for sure.
Well, but I think it's more than he's a loser.
The whole time he's trying to get fixed to go, and he's picking a fight, and he's being aggressive with, he even is willing to attack Gil. Like, that's why I say he's an agent of chaos.
So what do you mean he's an agent of chaos? Spineless.
Like you were saying that Mapes does. I think that Luke, now I'm like hedging on that, but I'm just going to follow through. I don't think he has a code. I think he has an inferiority complex, like a pretty profound one.
So do you guys ever
play
D&D, which I never have, but my kids do, right? And they have like the levels of your characters you pick there.
Right, right.
Like, so you can be a character who's chaotic evil, lawful evil, or mm-hmm. neutral evil, mm-hmm. right? So where would you Luke Will
chaotic in
the evil. D&D category?
So say them again. So for the people who are listening who don't know what we're talking about.
So in D&D, you pick characters and you pick their kind of like organizational bends, I guess. And then their level of moral goodness as character. So you can be chaotic, evil, or good, but for right now we're ranking villains, right? So you've got chaotic evil, which means they're like zombies, right? Like they're wicked and evil. No, sorry, not zombies are neutral. Orcs, right? From Lord of the Rings are chaotic evil. Like mm-hmm. they just do evil indiscriminately with no code, but they are truly evil and trying to be evil. And then you have lawful evil, which is somebody with a very strict code, like Sauron, like trying to gain power or whatever. I'll just say it like Fix, like his code, protect the family. He's lawfully evil. He has an internal code, but it's wicked. And then neutral, which is just someone who is essentially does evil, but doesn't really care if they do evil or not. Like they're neutral.
Is there a character from Lord of the Rings that fits that last description?
Gollum?
Oh, that's right. I think you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. It occurs to me that this discussion is sort of like we're laying out each of our visions of the ontology of wickedness.
Evil, right?
Yeah. Right.
So I'd say somebody like Griffin is like neutral evil. Like he might do harm, but it's going to not because he's trying to. He's just trying. Or even neutral evil might even be, what's the guy's name? The bartender guy?
T-Jack.
T-Jack. Yeah, like he's going to do some and contribute to the overall malevolence of the
I think Mapes would be neutral evil.
Okay.
Really, you think Mapes would be neutral evil?
I think he's neutral good.
Oh, this is so interesting. Oh,
well, if we're talking about bringing good into the occasion, there's such a fine line between neutral evil and neutral good sometimes.
Right. Like, I just don't think that Mapes is bad. I just think he's, I don't know. I don't, when I say that, then it's like, well, do I condone his racist actions? Of course not.
Of course not. Right, 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 right. Nobody's hearing that.
So anyway, that, like what I would say, I think that Luke Will is chaotic evil.
Hmm.
Not lawful evil.
Yeah. Yeah, I can get with that. I can totally get with that.
Yeah, he's actively, he's every moment when the drama of the scene suggests that Gil might be able to convince his father of something or engender some kind of pathos or suggest, you know, tell some kind of truth, Luke Will jumps in as if the devil on the shoulder, the demon, you know, the demon on the right shoulder saying that the angel on the left shoulder is full of, you know what.
Bull honky. So,
yeah, could you say that again for us?
Just right.
Have that as a pullout. mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but let me ask this question then. Why do you think the book takes this detour? The book is called A Gathering of Old Men, and that's what we've been given for the first roughly two thirds of the book, whatever, between a half and two thirds. And then here we're given a roughly 50, 60 page detour where all of a sudden we're in Gil's head and we're learning about the importance of SEC football in the in race relations. And the moment, you know, we get this Sully character who's talking about the salt and pepper, you know, Gil and Pepper, and how they're almost like agents of healing, right? And then we get the scene where we sort of, okay, even if we agree that Fix is evil, we are given a human version of him, right? We're given the child on his lap who he is saying this child no longer has a... There's a family culture. There's, you know, he's a man who's saying, I'm old now. 20 years ago, yeah, I would have just run out there. Now I'm not sure what I'm going to do. You know, there's all where he's humanized at least. And then we're given this scene in the bar with this teacher from Texas and, or from Louisiana, I guess he grew up in Texas, but he's, you know, raging Cajun, from Louisiana Lafayette. And, you know, we're given all these different characters that take us away from the actual gathering of the old men. Why does the book do that, do you think? Heidi, you want to go first? Tim, sure. You're muted. Tim's already going, but he's muted. So now Heidi gets to... No, I'm just kidding. Tim, go ahead.
I think it's because we have a really, really fine author, and he understands like a basic premise of great narrative, which is... the size of the enemy and the ferociousness of the enemy, there's a direct proportion between the size and ferociousness of the enemy and the satisfaction of the conclusion of the book. Now, we've not gotten to the conclusion of the book, but the fact that he has shown the other side and given voice to the other side, to me, makes me think, okay, we are in really good hands here, because he's not afraid to treat his opponent with... He takes his opponent with real seriousness. One of my, you know what? I'm about to go on a rant. I just, like, heads up. One of my, like, least favorite movies of all time is this movie that came out, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, called Amazing Grace, the story of William Wilberforce and abolition in
so many England. People right now.
So many people right now. What?
That you like, that you hate this movie.
The screen. This is like a homeschool staple.
It is hard for me.
Rant away.
It is hard for me to kind of like pull back on the bridle bit when I think about that movie, because everyone loves... Okay, first off, it's a great story. William Wilberforce is a really great story. Amazing Grace, for me, fails on two different levels. The one that's most important for the sake of this discussion is the enemies of William Wilberforce... The forces of slaveholding in England are immediately laughable. You cannot take them seriously in that movie. Even the people that they cast, they should have cast the very best looking people in the room to play the slaveholders. Who do they cast? These two sniveling aristocrats who we just hold... What we want more than anything else is just to show dominance over... You know, it's just like... It's implausible. This is not what propped up slavery for hundreds of years in England or the United States. It's the things that our author in this book, Gathering of Old Men, is describing. It's all sorts of things like vested economic interest... It's all sorts of things like family legacies, guilt. These are all the things that once, like, slavery started to end, the effects of slavery remained, not because you have these sort of sniveling aristocrats who just, I just want to hold on. That's not what kept... this in place. What kept it in place?
Yeah, it's not why Jim Crow South became.
All of these other things. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I think I was so disappointed in Amazing Grace because they did not take the opponents of abolition seriously. They treated them like clowns.
Even beyond the historicity of it, from a dramatic perspective, a weak and sniveling enemy.
It's not easy to hard overcome. It's not hard to overcome. Sauron is terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. You're like, we can never win. We can never win. And so when the good guys do win, oh my goodness, it is so satisfying. And I think that's part of the reason that I remain so hopeful and optimistic about the conclusion of this book is that we are seeing the other side, and we're seeing like how Gil is, oh my goodness, his situation is so complicated. Mm-hmm. And even somebody like Mapes, his situation is so complicated. And I just have nothing but respect that our author is showing us that.
So we've had a lot of, well, Heidi, you're trying to answer the question.
No, I am, but
Do you want to rant on his rant?
I do not want to rant on his rants, because everything you're saying is true. I mean, so to tell a good story, you also have to humanize the enemy and make them sympathetic in some way, right? To have some kind of emotional response that's beyond triumph, that is human and nuanced. And I think we get that with Gil for sure. And maybe a couple of others, the family, the women, you know, the child and the wife and all that. And the culture, right? It does seem like a rich and close culture. But I wanted to just really quickly go back to the question of why we kind of zoom out from the gathering. And to me, I also saw it structurally. Remember the nesting boxes we talked about on the first episode, right? So we go from out to in towards the gathering, like as the first half of the book is these Black characters uniting in a common cause, right? Towards this gathering together. And then now in the second half of the book, we have the opposite direction, right? We have the white characters who are speaking on the other side, and we're zooming out to see what they're going to do about the gathering. And so we're getting further and further away from the actual geographical place where the action is taking place. It was moving towards in the first half, moving away in the second half. And then also, as you pointed out, Tim, we have the other craft reason gives us some skin in the game on the white characters. It actually matters to this community what happens to Matthew.
And that's a great point, Heidi.
There's going to be enduring consequences on the white and on the Cajun community, the same way there's going to be on the Black community. It's going to cost them something. It's already cost them something: personal grief and a public cataclysm. And that is, I think, important for us to have some kind of skin in the game on both sides of the issue, no matter where morally we stand on it. Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm.
Tim, yeah. I would like to bring back a classic close reads segment. Mm. I'm excited to bring back the Tim McIntosh predicts the end of the book segment.
Oh my goodness.
So I'd love, on the spot, without thinking anything of it.
Oh my goodness.
I would love to know what you think. A two-part question. Do you have a sense for what you think this book is going to end with? And do you have a sense of what you'd like it to end with? And those might not necessarily be the same thing. I just love to know, like, what are you kind of anticipating? What are you kind of hoping for?
Okay. What I'm hoping for, I know can't happen, because to some degree, it's like it would be a violation of human nature. What I really want to happen is for all the bad characters to have a moment of enlightenment in which they're like, hey, you guys, what we've been doing is terribly wrong. We need to change our ways. It's not too late for us and for our families.
Let's listen to Gil.
You really are angelically good.
What? No, that's what I want to happen, but I also recognize, like, the Black characters, the gathering of old men, that's what they want to happen also. And that's not what's going to happen. Okay. So let's just put that to the side. This is a long shot, because I have been struggling to see how Ernest Gaines is going to bring resolution to this book. I really don't know. I think that Gil is going to play a prominent role, because I was thinking, okay, what is a sphere of life in Louisiana that there is some sort of common ground? It's not economics. It's not the law. It's not family. It's not work. It's sports. And it's not even really
particularly SEC football.
Particularly SEC football. And it's not level yet, but Gil is a white running back. His kind of cohort is a Black running back. They're friends. And I think that that, and Gil is like really bound up in this. So I think that that kind of platform is, I think that Ernest Gaines is going to use that platform. The other thought that I have, again, this is a long shot, is that the chaos that is Luke is going to actually cause, it's his chaos making is going to backfire, and somehow like leaders of the community are going to, I wonder if it's going to be a Birmingham moment, like when the dogs and the fire hoses were brought out in Birmingham during the civil rights marches and everyone saw what was happening. That's when the civil rights movement began to really like gain momentum. And I wonder if something like that might happen with Luke, that he causes so much chaos and so much destruction that the people who need to see that see it and they say, no more, this cannot continue. And so the murder in some way is going to be, I don't know how it would be absolved, but in some way the murder is going to be absolved.
Well, we're going to find out next week, obviously. And there's a lot of people who are listening who are either cheering you on,
right,
or shaking their head
like, oh, Tim, you're so far off.
Yeah, well, we had to, I mean, you know, people love when Tim predicts stuff.
Yeah, because it's so laughable. I was so off with Rebecca.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the point of a mystery, though.
Yeah. And this is a mystery, isn't it? It's like a mystery of, it's in some ways, Crime and Punishment. We know who did it really, really early. We know who did it. The whole question is, in that book, why did he do it? That's the mystery. In this book, we know who did it. The whole question is, what's justice going to look like?
Next, right?
So then do you take, Heidi, do you take at face value that Matthew did it?
Like, I do, but I'm prepared for a twist. Like I am ready for, I am poised and ready for everything I think about this novel to be completely wrong. And I can just feel it building. I can, and I think it's going to be one of those perfect endings when you say, I did not see that coming, but it's the only thing that could have happened. Because I would not, I don't have any idea how I would end this story. Right? Like if I was the novelist here, I don't know how I would end it. I'd think this was a great idea for a novel and then I'd never write it because I'd have no idea how to end it.
Yeah. For sure.
But I think something's going to happen to Gil. That's my prediction. I think he's going to die.
Do you
and
really?
And I think that's why he's not in there.
That is so good because, okay.
That's my
the,
one
like,
prediction.
Watching public is got their eyes on Gil. And if he dies, yeah. I mean, he's like this esteemed running back. Oh, my goodness.
Because you know he's going to go with his family.
Right. That's a great guess. Oh, so, David, I would like to rewind.
Nope.
And
no
I
rewinding.
Change my first vote.
You can change your vote, though.
I appeal directly to our listeners. Listeners, hear me. I am following suit with Heidi. I've cast my lot with Heidi.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. And I am not cheating. I've not read ahead one single word. I am
okay.
Like in suspense.
So then do we think there's 17 old men with shotguns sitting on a porch and the possibility of a great conflict looming, the enemy on the horizon and so forth. Do we think shots will be fired?
Yeah,
I think so.
More shots we fired,
but I don't think from them. If I were to make a guess, but again, I'm probably totally wrong. I think it's the implosion of this other culture. Right, like the violence begets violence. The city divided against itself. But I don't know. Something
do you
to your point? It might turn out Matthew didn't do it. It might turn. You know, like there's all these other ways it could go to be a satisfying ending, although I've only thought of like maybe one, but like I said, I would have no idea.
It does feel structurally like our heroes or one of our heroes has to die. Right. Because, and the kind of, among the gathering, there is this unified sense that we have not stood up when people have done mm-hmm. us and our families wrong.
Right.
But now, no more. No more. And they recognize, they all recognize the cost of saying no more. It could cost them their life. It could cost them, you know, life in jail. It's almost like there's no way they're going to go to jail. They're going to die. And they recognized if this goes sideways, they recognize it. So I would like to add to my prediction, which is kind of like Heidi's prediction plus an addendum, plus a PS. I do think that one of our heroes is going to die. And I think that's going to be part of the pivot.
So we talked a little bit last week about the idea of justice, because on the one hand, you've got care, you know, the question is someone going to pay for this murder? And then you've got the question of whether the murder itself is justified, which is almost a question that isn't even really, the book isn't really even asking
it's
us that,
not
right?
Asking that question at all.
And we may get to that. Like we may have a court case or something like that, that asks us to think about, was Bo getting killed justified? On the other hand, we've got the question of, so is someone going to pay for that? But then if the men, if shots are fired and these men do stand up for themselves, will they be justified? And would the family be justified in returning shots in defense of their brother, their son? And it seems like what we're getting is we're getting like this sort of microcosmic conflict of the moment that's being microcosmic, not in the sense that like it's actually cosmic, but like a microcosm conflict, this little conflict that is Bo dies. Some guys are standing up for their friend. Some people are standing up for their brother and trying to get justice for him. So on the one hand, we could ask the question, are they just in trying to get revengeance for their brother, right? For Bo. Is Bo's family justified in trying to get revenge for him? And then it becomes a revenge tale, right? Where there's a bazillion of those in literature and movies and all that kind of stuff. On the other hand, we have the question of, would these men be justified in standing up for themselves in this particular conflict? And then you've got the question of whether the murder is just, whether there's going to be justice for the murder in the first place. And I'm fascinated by the idea of the men, whether the men are justified in doing what they're doing, the gathering of old men. And it seems like the book is too, because the book isn't coming right out and telling us, like, we've got a lot of characters who were supposed to kind of, who would normally be seen as the wise, you know, the ones who answer questions of virtue. We've got the minister who's against this whole thing. We've got the police officer who is like, what are you guys doing? And a number of women who are saying, this is nonsense. Quit doing this. And yet they're saying, we've been up against it our whole lives. We've been persecuted. We've never stood up for ourselves. This is our chance. But then the book does seem to be saying, like, it seems to be like saying what the fact that they're doing that is courageous and you sympathize with them. But then when you step back, you're like, well, does that fact justify a battle? And the book doesn't seem to be saying for sure, yes, it does. Yes, it does. And so it makes it such a complicated book on race relations, especially being written by a black man who himself, surely growing up in this part of the world, suffered at the hands of the white people in the community.
Right.
And
agreed.
And perhaps he also had good relationships with, maybe he had a salt and pepper type of relationship like Gil and Pepper. But it just complicates the whole thing because we don't know we don't really know what question the book is asking, because there's all these different questions that it might be asking. And I find that really interesting, like in terms of the nesting dolls theory that you're talking about. Like it's almost like there's these nesting dolls of questions about justice that are being asked. And we're not really even sure which one we're supposed to be contemplating.
Right. Well, and to your point, the notions of justice within the characters seem to be very individual and personal, right? So there's not necessarily any character, maybe Gil's an exception to this, and there's a slight possibility that Mapes is an exception to this, but none of them seem to be asking what is the right thing to do. Most of them seem to be asking, how do I protect my own?
including the black characters, right?
I don't know if that's true, Heidi.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true for the black characters.
I think it is. I think what they're saying is we have suffered. I don't think they're objectively fighting for justice or to change underlying societal kind of roles. The only indication we get of that is Gil when he says,
"Well,
I've been trying to change this my whole life."
But
other
I don't
than
think
that, it's
I don't think the black men are trying to protect anything.
And I'm not. Right. Well, and I'm not saying that's bad because I think that's actually how all of us most of the time make decisions, right? And I'm not saying that's not an accusation. But it's what I'm saying is that their decision seems to be largely personal and communal, not objectively like what is the nature of justice and how do I fight for it right now?
Well, I think
like they're not being woke is what I'm saying.
No, I think what they're doing though,
I don't want Matthew to die. This man, and I want to stand for what I've been through and my family's been through.
Maybe.
Go ahead.
Well, Tim, you were going to say something too.
I just don't think that you can separate those two things. Like, the gathering of old men who take up shotguns are fighting for themselves and for their community. They're not fighting. I agree. They don't talk about elevated notions of justice.
Social justice.
But it still seems to me that's exactly the thing that's driving them to show up in mass and to claim the murder.
That's what I'm saying. I think it's better that way. I think it's more human. That's the argument I'm making.
That
I think it's disembodied to make it ideological and to say they're fighting for abstract social justice, right? Like if this isn't a book that's trying to make some kind of woke stand. It's saying we're humans and we're making human decisions based on our community, our family, our loyalties, and our love.
Like, yeah, I agree with that. But I don't think it's about protection. I think it is about justice in this sense.
Yeah, maybe
I don't think they're fighting because there's something. This goes back to what I was saying a minute ago. They're not doing this because they think what they're doing is just given the crime committed. What they're saying is we have been treated for centuries and throughout our whole lives in an unjust way. And it's finally time to just stand up for ourselves. So for them, it is a question of justice. The personal part is that they have been treated in an unjust way their whole lives. And so now it's time to just finally do something about it, whether it's just or not. That's kind of,
I agree with
whether that action itself is just in the given moment.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know that, like, I think maybe when you said the word protect, that was what threw me off because I don't think they're trying to protect. I think they're casting off the notion of protection. Like they haven't acted for their whole lives because they haven't protected themselves because they were trying to protect themselves. Yeah. Right. Okay. So they're trying to protect their friend.
Yeah. And their community. And but yes, I think we're saying the same thing. I probably just used a word that was.
Even that's interesting though. I wonder if they are, Tim, do you think they're trying to protect? I mean, I think in a sense they're trying to protect him because they like him. But I think the reason that Matthew doesn't he lets them do what they're doing because he recognizes, like, he doesn't tell them to go home because he recognizes that what they're doing is standing up for a lifetime of oppression they have experienced. Like, he's letting them do something for themselves, not for him, which I think is just another way of saying what Heidi's saying. Maybe
David, say that again.
So we talked last week when you were in Arizona about how there's the scene where Mapes is like, just tell them all to go home. Mm-hmm. And Matthew's like, they can do what they want. They're making decisions for themselves. They're doing this for them. And so I feel like what he's saying there is he is not, if he did it, he's not confessing to it because what he recognizes in them is the need to actually stand up for themselves against because of the injustices that they have faced for so long.
Yeah.
Like, there is something irrational about there. And I don't mean that in a negative sense, just like it's a deep guttural, like deep-seated response to being treated like, pardon my French, crap for so long. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think, why he lets them do it. I think that there is, none of them come over there and say, like, you know how we're getting all the stories about why they come. None of them are like, Matthew's my buddy. So we're going to stand up for him.
True.
They're all like, my sister was raped. My brother was beaten by sugar cane or whatever. So for them, and I think that what they're saying is that we have lived injustice our whole life. Mm-hmm. Even if the moment that we're, even if what this particular crime, so this, it might not be just for us to do what we're doing given the particularities of this moment and this particular crime. But because we have lived in a world of injustice, this is our moment to finally stand up for ourselves against all the injustices our community has suffered for a long time. It may not be in keeping with what happened right now. And yet this is the opportunity for us to actually have a voice. That's what I'm...
And I think the fact that Matthew is the character that has stood up against whites on various occasions. And like, he's strong. And I think...
And he also has good relationships with a couple.
He does, right. Because he's friends with... Like even Mapes. Fishing with Mapes.
Yeah.
I think part of what makes this moment so poignant for the Black community is that it's Mapes that's being accused. And if it, you know, like, he has stood up kind of on his own many times
do you
in
mean
the backstory.
Matthew,
I'm sorry. I said Mapes. Yeah. I meant Matthew.
Yeah.
He has stood up on his own so many times, and now he's accused. And so part of the reason it's such a galvanizing moment is they respect him so much. He's become like an icon to them in so many ways. So it really fits that they're all going to come and like take whatever, not credit. They're going to, you know, kind of self-accuse. Mm-hmm. Because Matthew was so, so respected by them. It'd be interesting if it was, I don't know that this would have happened. I don't know there would be a gathering of old men if the same event happened with a different, less respectable perpetrator from the Black community.
Right.
I don't know that this would be the galvanizing moment. I don't think it would.
The question of it wouldn't have happened at all without Candy either is a fact, kind of an interesting part of this whole thing, which I think still needs to get unpacked.
And there is a loose end in this story, which is why doesn't Candy just take Matthew away, right? So there is, that's a hole to me. That's like been my, it feels like kind of easy to plug up. And so I'm wondering if it's going to come, like they could have just made Matthew say, this is my land and I'm not leaving. You know what I mean? Like, but there's no explanation for why.
Like, why don't they run away and
just
hide?
Escaping, knowing that Vix is coming in several hours. So they'd have a head start. Right. So there's, to me, there's, that is a glaring hole in the plot.
It never even occurred to me.
And I'd like to know if that's going to be plugged up. If not, I think it's a flaw, but there's still time.
Yeah. We got some pages.
Yeah, that didn't even occur to me because I just assumed he would get caught by the police down the road. That was kind of my thing. But we can, yeah, we'll see. Hey, Tim, I know you need to go.
Yeah.
Are you done? You want to have a final thought? You got to go.
I'm great.
Tim's got to go.
I'm great. Yeah.
All right. Heidi, do you have any final thoughts on this episode? Next week, we're obviously going to dig into the ending and then we're going to have a Q&A episode. So those episodes will go a little longer.
I don't. My final thought was that hole in the plot question that's been kind of nagging in my mind. I've been wondering about it. So I'm wondering if at some point it's going to be plugged up.
I just want to say that the scene with Gil and his dad, the drama in that scene.
I know.
You know, it felt like it. Honestly, I kept thinking of Hemingway when we were reading that. The writing is like super Hemingway.
Yes, the repetition.
The repetition, the short sentences, the like the, you get the first person, the way he uses first person POV.
The unsaid subtext, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the difference here, like, you know, Hemingway, I think his subject matter probably is what turns a lot of people off more than his writing. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But this, it reminded me so much of the best Hemingway. Like, it reminded me so much of The Killers, the short story. I don't know if you ever read that. And like that, like it's like a bottle episode of TV where you're all just in, or a stage play where you're just all in a room and the tension is growing and growing and growing. And you've got, even the way he like stages the people with Gil sitting there with his hands on his hands clasped and different people standing in different parts of the room and the child in the
and
grandfather's lap.
Papa and over again.
That scene is, that's one of the best chapters I've read in any long book in forever. Time. Yeah. It's I so agree. Precise well, and good.
I do have one more final thought, Ben, based on what you just said. And it's this, that this whole section makes me take back entirely what I said last week about the stories kind of being too close together in that one section that we read last week about from Lou Grimes. Because I think we need that in order to balance out the poignancy of this section that we just read, because it's so, so emotional and so personal and so human. And it makes the moral tangle of this book like even more poignant. And so I think I totally take back what I said last week about, man, there's just kind of a lot. It's a bit heavy handed in this section, because I think we have to have that, to counterbalance, to harmonize the poignancy of this particular section. Mm.
Well, with that, let's see what happens in the next week when this book ends. This is a great book.
It's so
great
good.
Book, great writer.
Just so we're love so it.
Next week we will finish the book, and then we'll do the Q&A after that. And then we're going to dive into Confederacy of Dunces. One quick announcement. At the end of the year, what we're going to do is, for the sake of time, we're going to still do Henry Greene's Loving, but we're not going to do multiple episodes on it. It's not a very long novel, but we're going to do one episode discussing that novel. And we'll also do our end of year reading, and we'll do those in December, kind of before the new year starts. So we're going to, after this book in early November, we're going to dive into A Confederacy of Dunces, another Southern novel that takes place in Louisiana. And then we're going to do one episode on Loving, in addition to all the sort of other end of year podcasts that we're going to do about our favorite books and all that sort of thing. The play's The Thing is going on right now. They're doing The Taming of the Shrew. Act 4 should be up now. I think it's Act 4. We've got Willie Wendell going on, lots of great guests, and we also have our new podcast, which is Bibliography. First episode was with Ron Rash, one of North Carolina's great authors. Second episode, which is up now, is with Alexandra Andrews, who wrote a novel called Who is Maude Dixon, which actually you're reading that right now, Heidi, aren't you?
I'm reading it right now. It's delightful.
How far did you get? How far are you?
So I'm about a third of the way through.
Okay.
So you haven't even, any time I can. Yeah.
You haven't even really hit the big.
No, I have not. They've not gone anywhere yet, which I know is.
Well, they're going to end up in Morocco.
I recommend it. It's great.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite mysteries that I've read this year. We talked about all the books that she loves. And so if you like podcasts that will help you come up with things for your TBR pile, then just make sure you subscribe to Bibliography wherever you get podcasts. Okay. With that, I guess that's it. Anything you want to add, Heidi?
Well, just this thing popped in my head when you were talking about that and thinking, I think some of our readers will, or our listeners, excuse me, will relate to this. I'm like the rare reader that actually needs help with new books because I read so many old books. And I think a lot of our listeners will relate to that. So this is the kind of podcast that I need in my life to help me know what is new and what I should read that's being published now and also good.
Although I will say I talked, one of the questions I ask all the guests, usually the first question is, what was the first book that you fell in love with as a child? So we do all, and then we also talk about what role classics play. So you'll hear a lot of contemporary people talking, yes, about modern books, but also like what are the books that made them want to be writers and so forth. So
can't wait.
All right. Well, with that, for Tim McIntosh and for Heidi White, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, happy reading.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.